This is Monocle on Design, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Today we're back at the 16th annual Venice Biennale. We speak to the curator of the Israel Pavilion, who's offering a little sage advice on sharing time as well as space when it comes to buildings in the Holy Land. Also today,
postmodernism was ultimately about a polarity of styles, lots of different things competing, and kind of really going against this idea that architecture should all conform to a particular style, or architects should all just do things in a particular way. Postmodernism was really about celebrating variety, diversity and difference.
We brush up on Britain's postmodern architecture at an exhibition dedicated to this long maligned but increasingly modish style of building. Plus,
the way we live in our cities, we live in closed bubbles, social enclaves that sort of operate almost independently from each other. And the public space really has no value in our cities. Walking is not a common mode of transportation. So that was really the focus of the exhibition.
Saudi Arabia's solution to urban sprawl and how diligent design might offer a better revenue stream plus a more enjoyable way of life to the oil-dependent kingdom. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. First up this week, we're back in the Giardini, a pretty gravel-lined exhibition space that forms part of this year's Venice Architecture Biennale. This year's show, which is open to the public until late November, features exhibitions from some 65 nations, which have each interpreted this year's theme of free space. The Israel Pavilion is a thoughtfully put together space entitled In Statu Quo. The name refers to the many but often uneasy ways in which competing communities and religious groups have found, shall we say, uneasy truces and compromises to sharing space. I spoke to architect Deborah Pinto Fededa to find out a little more about the exhibition.
What is interesting here is the commonplaces, the indivisible ones, the ones that are probably the most important in the church, like Jesus' tomb or the stone of unction. They're common to all churches. In these places, they can't share space, so they share time over the space. Rights to clean, time for celebrations, and maintenance rights.
So is there some suggestion here that when we think about the density of our cities moving forward, when we think about seemingly intractable conflicts, that there are other solutions and there are ways, even if those ways seem rather fragile, of sharing space by sharing time? And that, I think, also speaks to another aspect of the exhibition upstairs.
Yes, totally. I think that here it's kind of pushed to an extreme due to the very sensitive, emotional and important part of religious places. But of course, we can use the same lens to look at our cities, the problems of density and sharing and living together, for sure. If we think about the case of the tomb of the patriarchs upstairs, it's a very interesting case because the place is, after having been very disputed between Muslims and Jews for many, many years, and after several events, violent events in the tomb, the status quo today is that Jewish people and Muslim worshippers share this place, but hermetically separated. They never meet. Each one has its own access, and the place is cut in two, except for 20 days a year, which is called the Jewish exception and the Muslim exception, where the whole place is just cleaned, wiped out with all Jewish artifacts to become a mosque, and vice versa, where all the Muslim artifacts are taken off and it becomes a synagogue. This happens every time for 24 hours and for all the main religious holidays of both religions. So there is some kind of coexistence, a fragile one, of course, but it is working.
And I'd also like to ask you about the alternative. One aspect of the exhibition deals with partition. It deals with the building of a wall, which I would argue is not always the perfect solution. Is this the counterpoint you're offering to sharing spaces and sharing time? Is this the sort of the worst case scenario?
Yes, this is also another very interesting case. It's the Rachel's Tomb. Rachel's Tomb used to be open to all, an exemplary place for coexistence between Christian Muslims and Jews over the years. And there was always a dialogue between all the parties. And the moment this dialogue stopped and one party took over and broke the status quo, so what happened is that the separation wall between Israel and Palestine went out its path to go and take an enclave, Rachel's tomb, within Israeli party, but inside the city of Bethlehem. So in that moment, of course, we only in the exclusion for only Jewish worshippers. And yes, we're very far away from dialogue. It's probably, yes, the worst case scenario. We still kind of want to believe that we are such a tiny part in historical events that eventually this is very temporary and something else will happen.
Many thanks to Deborah Pinto-Fededa there for bearing with us on what was rather a noisy day at the Venice Architecture Biennale. In May, the Preservation Society Historic England upgraded 17 structures to listed status in the UK. This means they can't be meddled with and implies a certain level of historical importance. Now, postmodernism as a style is tough to tackle, but it developed in the US in the 1970s, when architects who were bored of the straight lines and concrete finishes of modernism threw off the aesthetic shackles. Now, postmodernism as a style is tough to tackle, but it developed in the US in the 1970s. It was here where architects who were bored of straight lines and concrete finishes associated with modernism finally threw off the aesthetic shackles of their forebears. The new generation embraced bold shapes, colours and a bricolage of historical styles and ideas, plus a little wit and ornament thrown in for fun. It wasn't long before the first postmodern structures sprang up in Britain too, first in the shape of the British Library in 1973, and later the landmark No. 1 Poultry Building by James Stirling. No. 1 Poultry is the youngest listed building currently in the UK. To this day, postmodern buildings in Britain divide. Some see them as innovative, bright and bold, while others feel they're dingy, dull and dank. A new exhibition at the Sir John Soames Museum here in London is exploring the legacy of postmodern architecture in the UK through a series of objects, furniture, models and drawings. Monocle's Daphne Karnesis met with Owen Hopkins. He's the senior curator of exhibitions and education at Sir John Soames Museum, and he took Daphne on a short tour.
Postmodernism is always very difficult to define, but I think insofar as it relates to British architecture, it's about a renewed interest in the architecture of the past, looking again at historic styles and re-engaging with the city as it existed, in contrast to, say, the modernist approach, which was more about wiping the slate clean and rebuilding the city anew. Postmodernism was looking at what was there and thinking about how a building might integrate with it, both in a kind of urban way, but also in an architectural way as well. And postmodernism looked to use decoration, colour, all these kinds of things to really reconnect architecture with the public. I think in the 1970s, architecture had lost its connection with the public, had lost its way. Postmodernism was a way of making that connection anew.
And what are maybe one or two examples of postmodernist architecture in Britain that people might know about or ought to know about?
Well, I think the most important work of postmodernism in British architecture is No. 1 Poultry by James Stirling, the youngest building to be listed, I believe, and a real landmark, I think, in the City of London, a building that is incredibly sophisticated in how it draws from the incredibly rich architectural heritage of its site, where you have buildings by Lutyens, by Hawksmoor, by Sir John Soane, and interprets these surrounding buildings and brings it all together, but in a way that is entirely its own and entirely new. And, you know, it's I think, when you go walking down Poultry or walking down Queen Victoria Street, it is a really special experience, I think. The building envelops you, and then you kind of decide perhaps you'll walk through from Poultry to Queen Victoria Street, and then suddenly you're in this amazing sort of internal atrium lit by the sky, and your eyes are kind of cast upwards, and you see this extraordinary complex geometry and different colours interacting. It's a great experience and it's a really fantastic building. Postmodernism was ultimately about a polarity of styles, lots of different things competing and kind of really going against this idea that architecture should all, you know, conform to a, you know, particular style, or architects should all just do things in a particular way. Postmodernism was really about celebrating variety, diversity and difference.
Do you think that also drew some criticism in? Because I know that people were quite critical of it as well, maybe because of this variety and, I guess, risk-taking in a way.
Well, definitely. And certainly in its early days, in the late 70s, there were a lot of committed modernist architects who saw this stuff as a complete aberration. They barely even thought of it as architecture at all. But I think subsequently, given the way that postmodernism was appropriated by commercial architects, developers, and for some became the sort of the architectural style of the 1980s and of Thatcherism and all those kinds of things, that was another way of kind of arguing against it and of really kind of trying to consign it into the dustbin of architectural history. But as this show is trying to say, that kind of subsequent history, it was, you know, not necessarily the fault of that early radical moment of postmodernism. And it's that sort of early pioneering spirit that we're trying to capture in this show. And I think it's that really has something still to offer the present moment too.
Shall we have a little walk through? Can you tell me where we are now?
We've crossed the threshold into the south drawing room, one of the iconic sewn interior spaces. And here we've intervened, I suppose, with some postmodern objects. So the first thing you see as you walk in is one of the egg cup finials from Terry Farrell's TVAM building, one of 12 that he added onto the long facade of the building that faced the canal. And it's obviously a sort of witty take on sort of classical finials, which, you know, might be a kind of pineapple or something like that, but has reworked it so it has a kind of a different kind of meaning that relates to the owner of the building, TVAM, which was the first breakfast TV franchise. So if you're going to design a finial for a building, what better thing to choose than a boiled egg in an egg cup? And it was sort of taken to heart by the station and was used on trailers and idents and things like that. So that's the first thing you see. So it's this kind of announcement in a way. But I think the fact that it's partly yellow, and this is a very yellow room, maybe allows it to blend in a playful and perhaps slightly subversive way too.
Okay, so I can see the MI6 building, a model.
Yeah, this is probably the most iconic building of postmodernism. And I think it was a building that was quite important to include because it's the one kind of building of that era that people who know nothing about architecture can identify, partly, or maybe mainly, due to James Bond and the fact this building has been shot at and blown up many different times. So we have this very much sort of photorealistic model. It's one of the first things you see as you enter the room.
And am I right in thinking that most of these buildings are in London?
Yeah, the show is most, I think there's one exception, these buildings are in London. And the reason is, I mean, postmodernism in Britain was, I think, certainly an urban phenomenon and was partly shaped by the experience that these architects had of what modernism, or what had been done in the name of modernism, to Britain's cities. And there are many examples of, I think, probably regrettable acts of modernist urbanism. So that was definitely kind of a key part in shaping how postmodernism emerged in Britain. But I think the fact that, as I say, almost all of these buildings were in London, I think says something about the politics and the economy of Britain in the early 1980s. And the fact also that a lot of, I mean, for example, the three projects by CZWG are all in Docklands. That is very emblematic of, I suppose, London's centre shifting east to some degree with the emergence of Canary Wharf, for example, and the transformation of Docklands from post-industrial cityscape to new residential boroughs. And the architecture of CZWG, for example, I think was really important in that. In a lot of their buildings were real kind of pioneering buildings and set the tone for those areas and for subsequent development, and gave a kind of new identity as well, which was so important if these developers were going to attract people to live in what were, I suppose, you know, reborn parts of London. This is a model for the St Mark's Road housing in Kensington. The model's by Jeremy Dixon, the project is by Jeremy and Finella Dixon. And this model was created for the Venice Architecture Biennale in 1980. And it was created in response to a brief put forward by Charles Jenks, represented in the show elsewhere. And he wanted contributors to create an architectural self-portrait. A very postmodern idea, I suppose. And
I was going to say it looks a bit like a face.
Well, exactly. That is the point. So what Jeremy Dixon did was he took the facade that he and Finella Dixon had designed for St Mark's Road housing, and he accentuated certain elements of it to make it look rather more like a face. And he's incorporated a mirror into it. That's one side. And then if you go to the other side, it's actually a photograph of Dixon himself looking at this model, where his eyes and his hair are actually reflected in the surface of it. So it is a very much a literal architectural self-portrait, is a building as a face. And this is a fascinating project. It's for a street of houses, and it took, I suppose, what now is the incredibly commonsensical route of designing a row of terraced houses, each with this facade. But at the time, this was a pretty radical act. This was still when modernist housing estates were being built, of blocks set in open space and all those kinds of things. This was really the complete contrast to that. This was about creating a row of houses that, in a way, that looked at how houses have been built in London for centuries, drew from lots of different sources, and reinterpreted them in a way that was also very much of its time too. So it wasn't trying to create something that looked historical, but it was looking at historical references and interpreting them. And I think really that's the sort of the key of postmodernism. It wasn't looking to the past and slavishly copying it. It was looking to the past as a way of bringing source material in that could be used and interpreted in the present to create a building that might have a life in the future.
That was Monocle's Daphne Karnesis speaking with Owen Hopkins. The Return of the Past, Postmodernism in British Architecture, is on until August the 27th at the Sir John Soames Museum here in London. For the next item, we're back in Venice at this year's Architecture Biennale, this time at the inaugural National Pavilion of Saudi Arabia. Now, the kingdom has been on something of a PR push of late, hosting its first ever Fashion Week last month. Under the banner Undesign, its Biennale exhibition looks at how the Middle Eastern nations' cities have sprawled and changed thanks to wanton construction and a little lax urban planning. Crucially, it also looks at how to reverse the nation's car reliance and make space more livable and lively for all. I pop by to find out a little more.
I'm Turki Gizaz. I'm a part of the BrickLab team. It's a design studio based in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. And we were very fortunate to win the competition for the first ever Saudi pavilion at the Venice Biennale this year.
And with great power comes great responsibility to talk about the themes and the ideas affecting cities and civilization and the built environment in Saudi Arabia, which, compared to a lot of countries, has changed vastly over the past few decades. How did you decide to tackle the project and what did you come up with?
We worked with two curators, Jawahar Al-Sudairi and Sumay Suleiman. They're both researchers. And I think that one of the first things that we needed to really bring up as an introductory topic for Saudi Arabia at the Venice Biennale was not to focus on the architecture of the country, but really to focus on the urban fabric of our cities. Our cities have really grown exponentially after the oil boom, and I think that this kind of uncontrolled sprawl over the past few decades has really changed our communities and how we occupy our cities. And I think that that was a very important thing to highlight before we can even start talking about architecture in the country.
There's a great little section of the exhibition here which uses a phrase which I think is very pertinent, which is quality of life. You talk about the inclusionary and the exclusionary way in which uncontrolled growth can change the way that people live and enjoy their cities. Do you think now is an opportune time for Saudi Arabia to think about how it structures this growth in the future? And is this a message that you think is being talked about enough?
I think there is definitely a refocus on how we use our cities and the quality of life that we create for ourselves, essentially. And I think that there has, in the past few years, there started to be more of an awareness about how we need to control development trends and really implement urban policies that sort of revert the phenomenon of sprawl. And of course, you have shifting the country from an oil-dependent economy to other sources of income really plays a key role here, because I think that there is a new focus on reducing car dependency in all of these cities. And I think that this exhibition was a very good platform to really not only speak about issues of urbanism, but also tackle the social issues that are really the result of this condition of our built environment now. The way we live in our cities, we live in closed bubbles, social enclaves that sort of operate almost independently from each other. And the public space really has no value in our cities. Walking is not a common mode of transportation. So that was really the focus of the exhibition.
So you've taken this big topic, urbanism, how we use our cities, car dependency, and these subjects are very transferable across cities around the world. But how did you take these big thoughts and these big ideas and put them into a single room? How did you structure the space to make people think about this?
So I think one really important element to the pavilion is the materiality of that we are using. So it was part of a long research that my brother and I do at our studio. The material we're using is a combination of resin and sand. And I think that the reason we use that material is to sort of symbolize two primordial states of our nation, which one of them is the oil economy, which has really glossed over all of our values and really transformed our society. And then the natural landscape of Saudi Arabia, which is predominantly desert. And in experiencing our cities, the empty plot of land, which is essentially just sand, is very present wherever you go. And also, I think that as a further connotation to the state of affairs in our society, which is a very conservative society, and I think to finally acknowledge how oil has radically changed the way we live, it's also trying to push for more change on a cultural level also, and to sort of understand and position ourselves with tradition in a way where we can evolve. In terms of the structure of the space, it's a series of 6 pods, and each pod has different radius which can catch a limited amount of people. And we sort of want the user as an experience to go through them and sort of feel these sort of enclosures. And when the visitor first comes to the pavilion, you're faced with projections of the 4 major urban centers in Saudi Arabia, which are Jeddah, the port city, Mecca, the religious capital, Riyadh, the government capital, and Dammam, the oil industry capital, basically. As the visitor goes through, you see how, over the past 2 decades, how these really very small walled cities have just blown up exponentially since the oil boom. And it really highlights the role that the oil economy has played in shaping our societies now. I think, in general, I think it's a narrative that sort of unfolds the story of how sprawl has affected our society and how people that are living in our cities today are trying to cope with these new conditions. And I think that the takeaway from here is that we need to rethink how we structure our urban policies so that we actually create environments that are more welcoming for people to use and really bring back the public space and give it back to the people.
And as a final question, I'd like to talk a little bit about commerce as something that shapes society. You as an architect will know that you often need to partner with a developer, and perhaps over the past few decades, it's been the influx of money and maybe not the influence of urbanists and architects. Do you think Saudi Arabia is at a good point to reevaluate and to put a little bit more of the power of building back in the hands of people who are thinking about the end result, not just the building going up and getting rent from it, or, you know, the developer kind of mindset. Are we escaping that in Saudi Arabia?
I mean, I think participating in the Biennale and the support that we had from our commissioner is a really momentous point where I think it will help people become more aware. And I think it's really safe to say that over the past, let's say, decade almost, development trends are shifting away from a car-dependent kind of neighborhood to more something that's more pedestrianized and more human scale. And I think with all of the developments that's been happening in our neighboring countries, I think that positions Saudi Arabia in a good way to assess future development also. So we learn from Dubai, we learn from Qatar, we learn from Bahrain, and I think it's a good position for us now to really think critically of how we can encourage developers to really rethink how to create these new neighborhoods or new communities.
Many thanks to Turku Hisham Gaziz of Jeddah's BrickLab studio there. He's part of the team behind Saudi Arabia's Unbuilt exhibition at the Venice Architecture Biennale. For more about the Biennale, you can listen to last week's show as a podcast, You Lucky Things. That includes interviews with the show's directors, plus the talented souls behind the UK and US pavilions, respectively. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. However, next week...
This is the first time in India an Indian is getting a prize from the world. And I think this whole idea of significance would then filter down. And the newspaper, the media, the politicians, the developers, and everybody else will start talking that there is something called architecture.
We sit down with esteemed Indian architect Balkrishna Doshi, winner of this year's Pritzker Prize. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the always patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.